Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Kimberly Atkins, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Delay, delay, delay. The rule immortalized by Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the film where Jimmy Stewart spoke till his voice came out, is coming under attack from Democrats who say it's paralyzing the Senate. Former Majority Leader Harry Reid called to abolish the filibuster earlier this month, saying it no longer serves its original purpose of encouraging bipartisan legislation. Current Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republicans disagree, seeing the filibuster as one of the last lines of defense in an increasingly partisan Senate. This hour on Point, the fight over the filibuster. And you can join us. What do you think of the filibuster? Do you side with Reid or McConnell on this issue? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, Stacey Abrams will join us to talk about her latest initiative against voter suppression. But now, to talk about the filibuster, we're joined by Ross Baker, distinguished professor of politics at Rutgers University. He joins us from Piscataway, New Jersey. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, Kimberly. Thanks.
And so I want to jump right into this. Everyone from Senator Elizabeth Warren to Harry Reid is talking about eliminating the filibuster right now. It's become rather a campaign issue. In fact, Senator Warren, who's also a presidential candidate, has said repeatedly that she would abolish the filibuster if Senate Republicans tried to stonewall a Warren presidency. Here she is in April speaking at the National Action Network convention in New York City.
When the Democrats have the White House again, if Mitch McConnell tries to do what he did to President Obama and put small-minded partisanship ahead of solving the massive problems in this country, then we should get rid of the filibuster.
So, Ross, why is everyone talking about this now?
I guess it's one of the few things that Elizabeth Warren and President Trump agree on. he's certainly gone on a record against the filibuster and expressed his frustration with it. But I think that right now, I think what we're seeing is really one of the more evil fruits of political polarization. I think that the filibuster originally was designed to give senators an opportunity, particularly senators in the minority party, to air their grievances, to slow down the process, to promote deliberation. And I think there was a time in which that more or less worked. I think that because there was a greater overlap between Democrats and Republicans, you had liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, there were opportunities really for senators to pause and reflect on things, compromise, rather than plunge precipitously into a decision on an up or down vote. Mm-hmm. But I think that ability has been very seriously undercut by the fact that there really are very few senators who kind of stand between the two parties. You can actually count them on the fingers of one hand. So I think that the pressure then is for, well, if it's impossible for senators to come together on anything, why even have the filibuster? Why slow down the process, which is to promote deliberation, when there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of deliberation?
And you mentioned promoting deliberation. Let's step back a little and explain a little bit about the history of the filibuster. Why do we have it, and why does it exist only in the Senate and not the House?
Well, of course, Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution says that each House of Congress has the ability to make its own rules. Prior to 1806, there was really unlimited debate in the Senate. You really couldn't stop debate for a vote. Then there was a rules change in 1806 that established Rule 22 of the Senate, Standing Rules of the Senate, which provided for unlimited debate, and that existed until 1917. And what happened in 1917 was that the United States was on the brink of war with Germany. Germany was attacking American merchant vessels. President Woodrow Wilson wanted those merchant vessels to be able to defend themselves against surface attacks by German submarines, and proposed to Congress something called the Armed Ship Bill. And this bill was filibustered, that is, subject to unlimited debate by a number of Republican senators led by Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin. And these were senators who came from states that had rather large German constituencies, German-American constituencies. So under pressure from President Wilson, John Worth Kern, who was then the majority leader of the Senate, and actually the first senator to have that title, instituted Rule 22 of the Standing Rules of the Senate, which provided for cutting off debate by a vote of 2/3.
And what this was meant to sort of give more power to minority members, right?
That's right. That's right. But it was also to facilitate the ability of the Senate to act, that there was now a procedure whereby you could cut off debate. But the threshold was a 2/3 vote. You needed 2/3 of the senators to agree to halt debate. So although it was difficult to halt debate, there was now a possibility to do so. And that 2/3 threshold existed until 1975, when it was lowered to 60 votes, three-fifths of the Senate. And it's interesting, 1975, this was a Democratic initiative. There was a Republican president, Gerald Ford. Yet at the time, the relationship between the parties was so different that a proposal to make it easier to cut off debate and move to a vote was the product of Democratic initiative, which initially at least empowered the policies of a Republican president.
And Ross,
I
want to fast forward just a little bit to 2013.
Sure.
We'll be joined by Harry Reid in just a bit. But I hear in Washington a lot from folks that it was Reid who actually was the first nail in the filibuster's coffin. He was the one who drove it in when he changed the rules on court nominees. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said to Reid in 2013, "You'll regret this, and you'll regret this a lot sooner than you think." Do you think he was right?
Well, that chronology isn't exactly correct.
Okay.
Actually, it was in 2005 that the Republican majority leader of the Senate, Senator Bill Frist, basically proposed essentially the nuclear option, which is, of course, to eliminate the filibuster when the Democrats were filibustering Republican judicial nominees. So really, the first shot in the filibuster fight was fired by the Republicans. In 2013. Indeed, Senator Reid did engineer a rules change so that the filibuster could not be used against lower level judicial nominees or administrative nominees. And then, of course, later on in 2017, Senator McConnell eliminated the filibuster even for Supreme Court nominees so that you could move those nominations much more rapidly. And that's exactly what's been happening with the Trump nominees.
And I want to get to a caller. Wayne is on the line from Grand Island, New York. Hi, Wayne.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, my comment is that what the previous person was saying is pretty much on point, and that Democrats have continuously, and I'm a registered Democrat, we're putting nails in our own coffin by limiting the filibuster. At some point, either party is going to be in the minority, and the idea that we did not have the filibuster is what got us our last two Supreme Court justices. And in the initial plan, the Senate was supposed to be basically the protector of minority rights, and the Senate Minority Leader by being able to slow down procedure was intended to invoke the consensus, if you will, and the two-thirds majority, or even the supermajority of the 60. But when you eliminate the filibuster for the lower court judge, it's just a matter of time before it's the Supreme Court judge. Mm. And, you know, I hate using this term, but now we're on that slippery slope.
Right.
And the only thing scarier than being on the slippery slope is that we're on the slippery slope and we're doing it to ourselves.
Wayne, I want to give Ross a chance to respond to that. What do you think about Wayne's observation, Ross?
Oh, I think there's much to his observation, and I think that the Democrats in the Senate have approached this situation with a great deal of trepidation. I know Senator Durbin, who is the deputy minority leader, has just recently kind of come around to the idea of abolishing the filibuster, and I think his reservations were really precisely the ones that your caller expressed. I think especially now that in any given 2-year period, we really don't know who's going to be in the majority or the minority, that the margin of control in the United States Senate over the last 20 years has narrowed. There was a time when one party or the other had, if not super majority, certainly very healthy majorities. Now, the difference is 52 to 48. The likelihood is that the party that, or not the likelihood, but the possibility that the party that is currently in the majority could be the party in the minority after the 2020 election.
And look, is it even feasible to have a filibuster? I mean, to the point that you're making, we don't have a time anymore where a justice like Ruth Bader Ginsburg can be confirmed 96-3, or a justice like Antonin Scalia could be confirmed unanimously. Every fight is political.
That's right. I mean, I think that the argument for the filibuster is undercut by the fact of polarization.
All right. You can join the conversation. What do you think of the filibuster? Do you believe that it is causing partisan gridlock, or is it a vital check on our legislative system? Coming up, former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid will also join us to talk about the conversation. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing the fight over the filibuster as it emerges as an issue in the 2020 election. You can join the conversation. Would you support repealing the filibuster in the U.S. Senate? And if not for repealing, what about reforming it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We've been talking with Ross Baker, distinguished professor of politics at Rutgers University. Joining us now from Henderson, Nevada, is former Democratic Senator and Majority Leader Harry Reid. Welcome to On Point, Senator.
Thank you very much.
So you recently wrote a New York Times op-ed on the subject of the filibuster, and in it you say that while the Senate is meant to be the slower, more deliberate body in Congress, you add, quote, what is happening today is a far cry from what the framers intended. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, let me compliment Dr. Baker. He is an academic who spent much of his life trying to understand the Congress, anyway. acknowledge that and have great respect for him. However, I may not be an expert in all areas of government, but I know a lot about the Senate. And I want your listeners to understand this. When Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader, he was majority leader for 6 years. I was a majority leader for about twice that. And during the time that he was majority leader, he had one filibuster to overcome, maybe two. excuse me. So during my first 6 years as majority leader, I had to overcome more than 100 filibusters. And as time went on, each year was worse and worse and worse. No one knows for sure. I guess you could figure it out, but it's not easy. I had to overcome hundreds and hundreds of filibusters. So I want to talk about the reason I moved for rules change. Of course, it wasn't the first time rules had been changed. But Obama was elected president. He was a very popular president. He had just been elected. There are things he wanted to do. And I was the majority leader. It was my job to quarterback stuff through the Congress with the help of Pelosi in the House. And here's where I found myself. Here's where the country was. They, the Republicans, even filibustered the Secretary of Defense. We couldn't fill cabinet officers. We couldn't confirm sub-cabinet officers. The D.C. Circuit, the second most important court in the entire country, we had four or five vacancies there. They wouldn't let us fill them. They would come to the floor and say, well, they don't have enough to do anyway. It's a very important court. We had over 100 judges we couldn't confirm. The National Labor Relations Board, they couldn't attack organized labor head-on, the Republicans. So what they did, they made it so we couldn't get a quorum on the National Labor Relations Board because they wouldn't confirm anybody. So I came to the conclusion that if Obama's presidency was going to be meaningless, I wasn't going to be part of that. So I worked with my Democratic senators. I said, I'm going to make a move to change the rules. And the rule change was so very important. We confirmed over 100 judges. We filled the D.C. Circuit. We got all the cabinet and sub-cabinet officers filled. It was something that was so, saved the National Labor Relations Board. We were able, as a result of that, to do Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, the Wall Street legislation that is still so meaningful, and many, many other things. We believe that as a result of that, we were able to pass a stimulus bill that created for the first time incentives for renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal. It was a magnificent Congress. In fact, some say that it's the most productive Congress in the history of the country, even more so than the first Roosevelt administration.
Well, Senator Reid, go ahead.
So I don't at any time ever think a mistake was made. It was the right thing to do. In fact, the Republicans took control of right after that of one house of Congress. And Obama's presidency thereafter was just a continual fight for the try to get some minimal things done. So we did the right thing, no question about it. And I believe now, I'm sorry to take so long, but I want to make sure I get my points. Right now, the Senate is doing nothing except confirming judges. That's all the Republicans are doing. Mm-hmm. They're in control of the Senate. It's 52-48. And all they do is judges. They're not allowed to vote on amendments of any kind. The Senate was a beautiful place. We did appropriation bills. They don't do appropriation bills anymore. Mm. We got a lot of stuff done, but now there's nothing going on in the Senate except judges. So I can't imagine why anyone thinks this 60-vote threshold is something good for the country.
Well, Senator Reid, Yeah, I want to get to that point about confirming judges and about Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, as I said earlier, said warned that you would regret that rules change in response to a filibuster by Senate Democrats on the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch in 2017. Senate Republicans voted to eliminate the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees. Defending that move on the Senate floor, McConnell blamed the Democrats for a rule change. Let's listen to that.
We need to restore the norms and traditions of the Senate and get past this unprecedented partisan filibuster. Therefore, I raise a point of order that the vote on cloture under the precedent set on November 21st, 2013, is a majority vote on all nominations.
And Senator Reid, in his own op-ed, McConnell said that the 2013 rules change led to a, quote, political avalanche that led to the confirmations of Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and the highest number of federal judicial appointments of any presidency's first term. He said that move will haunt Democrat for decades. What's your response to that?
I think that's a bunch of malarkey, and that's the softest way I can say that. It is ridiculous. What would Obama's presidency have been had we not done that? They made two, after he was elected, Obama, they made two decisions. Number one, he would not be reelected. They failed at that miserably. Number two, that they would oppose everything that he tried to do. They succeeded there. They succeeded because they opposed everything that Obama tried to do. And what we were very fortunate, we had a lot of Democratic senators. We had 60 for a short period of time. But the issue is this. Why in the world should the Senate of the United States be directed by 60 votes? That's, you talk about fake stuff. That's a fake lead. You cannot have a democracy when you have to get 60% of the vote. And the Republicans have mastered this stalling, doing nothing. There are no amendments, no appropriation bills, and that is wrong. Mm. And if anyone thinks we can suddenly go backwards, the water has gone over the bridge. We're never going to go back in the foreseeable future to the Senate the way it used to be. I would like it, but it's not going to happen.
All right.
How are you going to do it?
All right. I want to get to our callers. We have a lot waiting. Jared is on the line from Alpharetta, Georgia. Jared, go ahead.
Hi. When I turn on C-SPAN and watch deliberations in, for example, the Australian and United Parliament in the United Kingdom as well, everybody seems to be in a room and they're having a substantive discussion. Do you think doing away with the filibuster would facilitate substantive conversation and or restore the trust that the American people have in their institutions to pass legitimate legislation?
Thanks, Jared. I want to go to Ross first and then go to Senator Reid. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think the filibuster promotes attendance in the Senate or actually deliberation. Filibusters are not the filibusters that people associate with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Basically, this is basically a series of roll calls. So I think that, you know, a sense in terms of, you know, getting senators into the chamber, having real debate, really doesn't have much to do with the filibuster. It has a lot to do with the necessity for senators to do a lot of fundraising. A lot of the time is spent on the telephone, off the hill, trying to raise money. So I think really in that particular context, I don't think that the filibuster either promotes or deters deliberation.
Senator Reid?
Filibusters focus attention on the Senate, and I think that's good. I can remember Dale Bumpers from Arkansas. He loved to talk, and he was very, very good. Whenever he took the floor, not every senator came, but a number of them came because he was good. And what it did create is people would say, would the senator yield for a question? And he would say, yes, I'll yield without losing the floor. They would ask him a question. And so filibustering does on occasion help debate on the floor. But as Dr. Baker said, it's not panacea to having debate on the floor, but there are times when I've seen it. Has really helped a lot.
Okay, I want to go to Ted, who's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ted.
Yes. Hello. I love the conversation and the show, and I love hearing from Senator Reid. I wish he would talk to us about the distinction between an actual filibuster and the threat of a filibuster, because right now it's just too easy to threaten a filibuster. And if we had a rules change to eliminate the threat and have the only viable filibuster be an actual filibuster, that, I think that would be good for moving the debates forward. Thank you.
Senator Reid?
The issue is this. What has happened, Dr. Baker touched upon it. You know, in the days of the Senate that I look back with such reverence, for lack of a better word, we used to work together. There was collegiality. It worked out very, very well. And people would really do a filibuster. What has happened now, and this is what Dr. Baker touched upon, the week of the Senate is now, here's what it is. Come in Monday night, have a meaningless vote, go home Thursday at noon. That's the schedule. People get on those airplanes and off they go. They're doing fundraising, parades, and whatever else they do. And it used to be that members of Congress, Senate included, whenever they came to Washington, they brought their families with them. They don't do that now. There are senators and House members who are sleeping in their offices. They don't. Washington is not important to them. They want to go back wherever they were, whatever their district or whatever the state is. So I just think that we're not going to go back to the times of forcing people to talk. You can't do it anyway. The rules that affect filibuster are pretty set. You know, you have to anyway. It takes at least a week, sometimes 10 days, to get rid of a filibuster. Mm. So when the threat is going to miss my plane Thursday afternoon, no one wants that to happen, and that's too bad. We used to work weekends doing conference reports. That's never done anymore.
Well, Senator Reid, I want to ask you whether the filibuster can be used to serve other purposes, for example, like bringing attention to an important issue. In 2016, we saw Chris Murphy do a filibuster on gun control. We've seen Rand Paul do a filibuster against a CIA director pick over his objection on domestic surveillance. Is eliminating the filibuster taking away a tool that can be used by lawmakers in other ways?
Of course, you have to weigh the good and the bad, and my scales indicate that the filibuster now has become a detriment to getting things done. That's why my friend Mitch McConnell wrote that op-ed piece going back to the Founding Fathers. That was without any foundation whatsoever. The Founding Fathers never considered a filibuster. That's the reason the Constitution was written the way it was, and that history that Dr. Baker gave kind of gives a pretty good outlook and, I should say, overview of how we arrived at having a filibuster, because it wasn't always there.
Okay. Well, I want to put a different question to Ross Baker about the filibuster. Where do you see the future for it going? I mean, is it really feasible that this can last, given how different both sides are? We have some listeners are saying that the two-party system should be eliminated. So has it run its course?
Well, I think the filibuster is really a very good concrete example of the old adage that where you stand depends on where you sit. I was quite interested in Senator McConnell's op-ed in the New York Times, which ran around the same time as Senator Reid's. And Senator McConnell has now become a fan of the filibuster. And my sense is that Senator McConnell is looking ahead to the 2020 election and saying to himself, aha, we may well get a Democratic president and perhaps at least marginally a Democratic Senate. Maybe I better re-embrace the filibuster. I think that, certainly it's, as I said before, that the filibuster while once could be argued, basically in terms of deliberation, Senator McConnell cited Thomas Jefferson about enforcing great innovations on slender majorities, a quotation from Thomas Jefferson, and so on. I think we'll be talking about the filibuster and whether or not to modify it or kill it for years to come. I think it's going to hang around like a kind of unwelcome visitor.
And Senator Reid, I want to give you the last word in the few seconds we have left.
Sadly, it's now not a question if the filibuster is going to be removed. It's going to happen. It's not a question if, it's a question of when it's going to happen. Life of the filibuster is on life support now, and this is a miracle in the Senate. And we're going to go and have a new Senate, which saddens everybody.
That's Harry Reid, former Democratic senator from Nevada and Senate Majority Leader. Thank you so much for joining us today, Senator.
You bet. Bye.
And Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University, a former consultant to the House of Representatives Democratic Caucus, and former advisor to Senators Patrick Leahy and Chuck Hagel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kimberly.
After the break, we're talking to Stacey Abrams, the Georgia Democrat hoping to combat voter suppression nationwide. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have for Stacey Abrams? What concerns about justice in the ballot box in your state? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. She's not running for president. Instead, Stacey Abrams is hoping to make her mark on the nation by battling voter suppression. The Georgia Democrat grabbed the nation's attention last year when she ran for governor. She didn't win, but she never conceded. Now she's turned her attention to election reform. The new initiative is Fair Fight 2020. She joins us now from Atlanta. Representative Abrams, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk about your new initiative. It's called Fair Fight 2020, which is an extension of work you focused on long before this current campaign season. Explain to our listeners exactly what Fair Fight 2020 will do.
Fair Fight 2020 is a 20-state, multi-million-dollar effort to set up voter protection teams in the 20 battleground states. And we define those as states that have statewide elections this year, as well as states that are going to be pivotal in the presidential election, the Senate election, down ballot races, including secretaries of state and attorneys general, as well as states that have the possibility of flipping state legislative seats to participate in redistricting for 2021.
And how did you pick these 20 states that this initiative is focused on?
We did a great deal of deep research, and we looked at the states that have, number one, a history of either voter suppression or voter interference. We looked at the states that are going to have the strongest impact based on the margins of victory or loss from the 2016 election and also 2018. We looked at states where we have Senate elections that will help determine control of the Senate for 2020, and we looked at states that have secretaries of states races, but also states that have chambers that may flip and influence who controls redistricting for 2021 and beyond.
Now, I want to talk about how your own experience, including your run for governor in Georgia against Republican Brian Kemp, has shaped your view on this issue. I want to play a clip after the results were released from that 2018 governor's race. You said that your campaign was ending, but you didn't concede. And in that speech, you tied Brian Kemp's win to voter suppression tactics.
Let's be clear. This is not a speech of concession, because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that. But my assessment is the law currently allows no further viable remedy.
Talk a little bit more about that decision not to concede, even as the race ended, and how that election is informing your stance as you move forward with this new initiative.
Certainly. There's a lot that's been made of my refusal to concede and similar accusations against Trump and whether or not he will acknowledge the legal outcome of an election. And I want to draw that very clear distinction. I acknowledge the legal sufficiency of the election, that under the laws of Georgia as they stand, Brian Kemp became the governor of Georgia. But the problem I have is that the laws and their application are unjust. And that lack of justice is not whether or not I could become governor. There is no pathway where I become governor in 2018, and I'm very clear on that. But what is possible is that thousands of people were denied the right to vote in the state of Georgia through interference with their ability to get registered, to stay registered, to receive access to a ballot, and to have those ballots counted. My refusal to concede was taken from the way I was raised. My parents were civil rights activists. My dad went to jail as a teenager for helping register people to vote. They raised me to understand how pivotal and fundamental the right to vote is. And the challenge I have is that typically at the end of an election night, the conversation is about the candidates. It's not about the people. And my decision not to concede was one that came from the fact that we talked to hundreds of thousands of people. We generated interest from 1.9 million people, the highest number of Democrats to ever vote in Georgia. Mm. And concession would be to say to them that those who were sent away from the polls, who never made it to the polls, whose polling places shut down, who had their absentee ballots rejected or their provisional ballots rejected, that their efforts weren't worth it. Mm-hmm. My responsibility is to ensure that the right to vote, the right to have that vote counted, is sacrosanct. And concession says that the system works perfectly fine. I do not believe the system works perfectly fine.
Some Republicans called that decision not to concede evidence of you being a sore loser. What's your response to that?
I'm not a sore loser. I am someone who acknowledged absolutely that I did not win. Mm. But what I refuse to say is that the system is just. The system has to work for not the candidate. It has to work for that mother who is in between shifts and had to stand in line for 4.5 hours only to get inside and find that her name had been stripped from the rolls. The 92-year-old woman in Georgia who'd voted in every election since 1968 who was told she did not exist. Mm. And the tens of thousands of people who never bothered to show up because they lived in communities where they saw people arrested for trying to help their fellow citizens vote. Voter suppression is real. And the notion that I should not speak about it lest I run the risk of not being able to run for office again is anathema to me. My job is to make certain that democracy works. That's why I stand for office. That's why I do the work I do. And a sore loser would whine and do nothing. I'm not whining. I'm acknowledging the system as it is, but I'm also fighting for the system that we should have.
We have a lot of callers who want to talk to you. Gary is calling from Marietta, Georgia. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You're on with Representative Abrams.
Hi, Stacy. Good to hear your voice again. I just wanted to commend you on your fine work with Fair Fight, and I heard you mention a couple of minutes ago redistricting. I see that as a first thrust, and I would certainly hope that we could use Fair Fight's facilities here in Georgia to make sure that the next 2020 election puts in place a group of legislators who are not Democrat or Republican fanatics, but rather for democracy.
I agree that the responsibility is to make certain we have a process that is fair, that we've had bad actors on both sides. I would say certainly my experience in 2011 when I became Democratic leader showed that the overreach on the Republican side was fairly egregious. I cannot defend what preceded me, but I can tell you what I saw then was wrong. And that's why, in addition to FairFight2020.org, I've launched Fair Count, which is a census organization that is focusing on making sure that every person gets counted in the census, which is the basis for reapportionment, which is what leads to redistricting. And so I'm already working on that effort. And we're not only based in Georgia, but we're working nationwide to ensure a fair census count across the country.
Representative Abrams, in addition to the issues with the census and with voter suppression, there are a lot of issues surrounding the sanctity of the vote heading into 2020, including hacking, election interference from foreign adversaries. Are you doing work with respect to that, too? And what are your thoughts about that as we are just a little more than a year out from the next election?
We acknowledge that voter suppression has two faces. One is what's currently been promulgated primarily by Republicans, but I will say voter suppression is nonpartisan, or certainly it's not the province of one party, although the Republican Party has been more aggressive and assiduous about doing so in the last 20 years. And if you trace most of the most egregious events of voter suppression, it has been recently under the auspices of Republicans. But foreign interference is also very real, and that's why we focus on the three pillars. Can you register? Can you cast your vote, and can your vote be counted? And foreign interference often interferes with all three pieces: disinformation about registration, hacking when it comes to whether your ballot can be cast and whether it can be counted. That's one of the reasons we are trying to hold Mitch McConnell accountable for his inaction on election security. We know that hacking machines happens. We know Georgia was one of the most vulnerable states, but we weren't alone. And we believe that we have to call attention to voter suppression in all of its forms and do the work we can to forestall its effectiveness in the 2020 election.
All right, Lisa is on the line calling from Clearwater, Florida.
I just wanted to let you know, in our life, this experience is very real. My 80-year-old mother, who is blind and disabled, had to move in with me down here in Florida from Tennessee. And we have not been able to get her registered to vote. First, it was her birth certificate. We couldn't find it. We called the county that she was born in. They couldn't find it. Their records were incorrect. We actually, after 2 years, finally found her birth certificate. Mm. And then when we went to the state to try and get her registered to vote, they said, no, now we need to have your marriage certificate because your name has changed. Well, that also, she doesn't exist in that county anymore. They don't have any record of her whatsoever. So we're dealing with that. She's not able to vote. And on top of that, our state in the state of Florida is planning on changing our constitutional language to say only citizens can vote. This continuation of disenfranchising voters has just got to stop. I mean, the struggle for us is real. They want us to go to court. I can't take her to court in Indiana.
Yeah, Lisa, thank you so much for that. I want to let Representative Abrams respond.
We know that voter ID laws have the seductive appeal of seeming very easy and common sense. And that's one of the markers of the insidious nature of voter suppression. It used to be guns, dogs and hoses and billy clubs. And now it's the very facile question of, oh, you just need ID. Well, if you live in a state where you have to have a certain piece of paper that you can't get from another state, even though you have other proofs of who you are, that's the problem, that there are administrative hurdles that disenfranchise elderly people, they disenfranchise the poor, they disenfranchise students, and that's one of the reasons voter protection is so important, because voter suppression is no longer a single faith. It is multiple administrative hurdles that seem racially neutral and facially neutral, but have the very clear effect, an intentional effect, of essentially wearing you out so you don't bother to try. But there's also a psychic effect where communities see how hard it is and they decide to exempt themselves from the process because they don't want to fight that hard. She's lucky to have, this 80-year-old woman has children who are willing to help them. But imagine if you live by yourself and you don't have any of those resources, you don't know how to use the internet, and by the way, you live in a rural county that doesn't have broadband. You are sitting on the phone for hours on end hoping you get connected to someone who can help you solve this problem. Sometimes it's just easier to give up.
I want to ask you, I mean, you are a former candidate for governor in Georgia, former leader of the Georgia House of Representatives, and earlier this month you ruled out a presidential bid, but clearly you intend to remain on the national political stage. What's next for you? Will you entertain offers, for example, to join a presidential ticket?
I certainly would. I mean, I don't want to be coy. There are those who advise me against saying that out loud. But the reality is, of course, the work that I want to see for America, the progress I wanted to see us make, I would be honored to be the running mate of the Democratic nominee. But my responsibility is to do the work to make certain, no matter who that nominee is, we have a president who actually values Americans and values America and is willing to work towards an international order that benefits us all. My next step will be determined after this cycle, because there are other jobs I may wish to stand for. But my focus has to be on making sure we preserve our democracy, and that means fighting voter suppression where it occurs.
All right, Stephen is on the line. He's calling from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Stacey. I think you're the most exciting person in the Democratic Party right now. You have a certain je ne sais quoi that could drive the youth vote that I'm not seeing right now. But in my town, we have a large Hispanic community, and on the flip side of suppression is lethargy. Like, it's very hard for us to drive campaigns in the Hispanic community because they're so busy trying to get to the next dollar to focus on just, you know, making a living and running out of money, that if we don't drive these in a really intense campaign, it's hard to get them to come out to vote.
Absolutely. Our campaign in 2020 was intentional about, sorry, in 2018, my apologies, I'm jumping ahead. In 2018, our responsibility was to center those communities that are marginalized and disenfranchised and make it easier. We're one of the only industrialized nations that creates so many hurdles for simply exercising the rights of citizenship. But we have to make certain we don't mistake lethargy for despair. And often what we have is despair. Why fight for something that you are entitled to and you know it's going to be made so difficult? But it's also the responsibility of candidates and communities to connect the dots between making sure people know that the right to vote is directly connected to your economic security. The right to vote is directly connected to your access to health care, to proper education for your children, to climate change protection. We have the obligation, no matter where we stand, if we know better, we have to do better. And that's one of the reasons FairFight2020.org is pulling people in, not just to give us resources, but to volunteer, because we have to create an army protecting voters.
Now, you're linking voting rights to all of these other issues that we're hearing the candidates currently running for president bring up, things like health care and all the other issues. Do you think that they are talking enough about voter suppression? I mean, what do you think about where the focus in this race has been so far?
I think that we have seen great responses from the presidential nominees. I've talked to all of the candidates with very few exceptions, and I've been very insistent that the things I need them to talk about, one, voter suppression is real, and two, Georgia is a battleground state. And I've been very pleased to see presence in Georgia, but also very thoughtful plans for how to tackle voter suppression. But part of the responsibility of a candidate is to talk to people about how they will address their problems. I've taken it upon myself in the work that we're doing with FairFight2020.org to make certain that people have the ability to exercise their values and vote for the candidate who will help address their issues.
Stacey Abrams, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.